Deputy Chief Justice of the Court. Our office had previously moved the admission of Mr. Lawless, who will be doing the argument this morning, and I introduce him to the court at this time.
Welcome.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. First, before we start, I would like to thank the court for granting my admission pro hoc vici. It's an honor to be here. This is a court with a great tradition, and I'm delighted to be here. That being said, I'm going to ask the court to reverse a first-degree murder conviction on the basis of several of the points we raised in our brief. I realize that is something that many courts are loath to do, but that this court will consider these issues seriously. And I'd like to focus, for purposes of this argument, on two issues primarily, and take them in slightly inverse order than we raised them in our brief. The first issue I want to address is one that most courts, for the most part, rule against defendants, and that deals with the admissibility of crime scene photographs in this case. It's unusual in this case for a couple of reasons, and I'm talking primarily about a videotape of one of the crime scenes. And there were two crime scenes. I'm sure the court's familiar with the facts. You've already heard argument in the companion case involving Michael Jones. But there were two crime scenes in this case. One of them was on Coleman Street, in a home on Coleman Street. Another was at a parked car several blocks away. Photographs of the parked car crime scene were admitted over objection, and a videotape of the Coleman Street crime scene was admitted again over objection of defense counsel. What makes the videotape issue, I think, particularly interesting from my perspective is the trial judge, Judge Abelman, specifically ruled that the videotape of the crime scene was unfairly prejudicial. Not prejudicial, but unfairly prejudicial. And the objection that was made by defense counsel, Mr. Figliola, was not so much to the concept of the video itself, but the manner in which the videographer, the police officer, focused on, for want of a better term, the blood, the gore, et cetera. In fact, and I might have, having reread my brief, might have sounded unnecessarily facetious, but if you listen to the Detective DiNardo, who is giving the narrative of the crime scene video, it almost sounds like a Roger Corman slasher movie. Now, granted, this is a murder.
Now, when Judge Abel made the statement about unfairly prejudicial, she made that in the context of a ruling under Rule 403, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
So, I mean, and the language from Rule 403 is the probative value
outweighs the prejudice.
Substantially outweighs the danger of unfair prejudice. I mean, didn't she just... Can it be read that she just simply eliminated or misspoke or left out the words danger of unfair prejudice?
Your Honor, you might be able to interpret it that way, and it's entirely possible that may be what Judge Abelman went. This was her first homicide trial, as I understand it. However, it's not what Judge Abelman said, and what I think makes this a unique instance, and I realize standing in front of an appellate court and saying, crime scene video, it needs to be reversed. But what makes this unique is the fact that in this case, there were dozens of photographs. There was a live eyewitness at the scene who testified, who could describe the crime scene. I believe she said that the video would aid in the presentation to the jury. There were numerous other ways that the essence of that scene could have been conveyed to the jury without Detective DiNardo going, there's blood, click, there's more blood, click, there's... It's just blood, 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 blood. And that was the nature of counsel's objection, not to the video itself. And I think once a trial judge says that it's unfairly prejudicial, it's, as the gatekeeper, it's the trial judge's obligation to either find a way to mitigate or eliminate that prejudice. As a prosecutor... And again, this is a phrase I used in my brief. I think a prosecutor, if you have the opportunity in a murder case, particularly a double murder case, particularly a high visibility double murder case, you want to bathe the jury in a bucket of blood. That's the way a prosecutor thinks. The defense lawyer obviously wants to throttle that back. It's the trial judge's job to try to maintain that balance. And once Judge Abelman reached that conclusion, which I think was warranted, it was the trial court's obligation to find a way to either mitigate the unfair prejudice, and again, the unfair prejudice, or eliminate it. And never once did Judge Abelman say, okay, let me see the other pictures. There were edited videos presented in this trial. Can you take the DVD back, put it in your computer, and just eliminate some of the blood and gore so that they focus on the scene and not fan the flames of what happened, because it was clearly a horrific scene. The trial judge did nothing other than to say, literally, and I know Judge Abelman from the sentencing, and I don't mean any disrespect for her, but it almost reads like she mouthed the words. Okay, it's unfairly prejudicial, but the prejudice outweighs the probative value. But there were numerous other ways in this case, based on other incidents of evidence that were presented, that she could have tried to mitigate it, and it just wasn't done. Now, that standing alone, I think, is creates unfair prejudice that could have flamed the fan of passion in the jury, that could have made the difference between the finding of first-degree or third-degree murder or a lesser degree of guilt. When you look at the...
Well, we don't have third-degree murder.
Sorry, on force of habit. I apologize. When you look at the other crime scene photographs that were admitted, and these were the photographs of Cedric Reinford, I think the court has to bear in mind that the defendants were charged, or that Mr. Page was charged, with murder, arson, related offenses to the murder and arson. They were not charged with tampering with evidence. They were not charged with mutilating a corpse. And in both cases, I believe, but certainly in Mr. Page's case, there was no challenge made to the fact that there was arson involved. The arson aspect of it wasn't contested. When the photographs of Mr. Reinford...
Did the jury acquit on the arson charge?
No, Your Honor. I believe the jury found him guilty.
Okay.
When the photographs of Mr. Reinford were presented to the court, the judge looked at them, and simply her ruling was that they will assist the arson investigator, whose name escapes me. They'll assist the arson investigator in his presentation to the jury. There was no conclusion whether or not they were prejudicial or the rule 403. Balancing that the court should have done. She simply said, okay, we'll let him in. Then when you read the arson investigator's narrative with the pictures, and again, I don't mean to speak ill of the dead, and I mean no disrespect, but he's describing Mr. Reinford's body, and he's talking about his thigh where the skin split open in a manner that reminded me of what a hot dog would do on a grill. And the same thing happened to his stomach. None of that was really relevant to the arson charge, nor would it have been necessary in proving the arson charge, were the arson charge contested, which it was not. Again, there were numerous other photos, videos, pictures taken, and the actual body of Mr. Reinford, he was dead, according to the evidence, he was dead of two gunshot wounds to the head before the body was set on fire. And I'm not saying this was a horrible, horrible thing, but the fact is that's one aspect of it that the jury did not have to see, and I think either alone or in combination with the unfairly prejudicial video, this is one of those instances. Again, I don't know Judge Abelman. I believe in this instance she abused her discretion. The other item that I wanted to really focus on in the oral argument is the first item which we raise in our brief, which addresses what I submit to the court were structural errors in the prosecution of Darryl Page, which were of constitutional dimensions. Mr. Page was an indigent. He was appointed to conflict counsel to represent Mr. Figliola, Mr. Gabay. Right out of the box, defense counsel contacted the trial judge, informed the trial judge that they were, and this may be my word, I don't know if it's theirs, I just can't remember, they've sort of melded, but they were overburdened with other court-appointed homicide cases such that they were not going to be able to bring, you know, to bring the case to trial within a reasonable period of time, that they were not going to be able to comply with the administrative directive that was, I believe, set forth by this court of bringing that case to trial within a year. And essentially, the first thing they did was they went to the trial judge and said, Your Honor, we can't aggressively protect our client's right to a speedy trial under the Sixth Amendment applicable to the states under the 14th. Now,
is the record on that the letter, or is there a transcript?
It's in the docket entries, Your Honor, and it's pretty detailed in the docket entries. I don't recall whether I've attached the letter or not, quite frankly.
That's in there, but is there a further transcript?
Your Honor, there's nothing that I'm aware of. And when I first looked at the issue, I sort of shrugged my shoulders and said, what's the big deal? But then I thought about it for a minute. Noticeably absent from the record is any sort of assent or acquiescence from the defendant with respect to that. But more importantly, I started to think about it in the context of this is a capital murder case. This is the defendant who is on trial for his life. Gideon versus Wainwright and the other cases make it very clear that an indigent defendant is entitled to the representation of effective and competent counsel. You know, the cases are clear. He's not necessarily entitled to Edward Bennett Williams, but he's certainly entitled to more than Elmer Fudd. He's entitled to something in those parameters, and that counsel has to have the ability, particularly in a capital murder case, where I think every possible defense, every possible constitutional right has to be zealously protected, has to be able to be asserted by counsel. Because perhaps 10 years from now, 15 years from now, either before this court or a federal appellate court or a U.S. Supreme Court, that one constitutional right that hasn't been protected may be the difference between your client's life or death. So right out of the box, their first message to the court is, we got to waive the right to a speedy trial. At that point, Judge Abelman's response is, okay. Rather than, before I accept your request, I'm going to go back to my list and maybe have my clerk or my secretary call three or four other counsel who were on the conflict list and see if they can do it. The court didn't do that. And I think at that point, you have the initial infringement on that right to a speedy trial. Later in the process, as the investigation is progressing, counsel attempts to retain an investigator.
I just want to be clear on one thing.
Yes.
You say they waive Mr. Page's right to a speedy trial.
Well,
is that wording in there? Or?
No, Your Honor, it's not. They walked in and said, Your Honor, we can't proceed to trial within that period of time. Whether it's a waiver, whether it's a request for a continuance or not, it is a request, and I think what makes it different from private counsel is it's a request for a continuance by counsel who are essentially employed by the state, and in theory, at least right out of the box, Mr. Page doesn't have a choice. If this is the counsel who he's appointed, and they're too busy because of other court appointments, that's the situation he finds himself in. And what I'm suggesting to the court is that if indigent defendants are going to have court-appointed counsel, they have to be counsel, particularly in capital cases, who are capable of protecting all those rights, and a defendant should not have to be in that position.
Oh, Mr. Wallace, you blended a couple of constitutional arguments in your brief. You talk about assistance of counsel, but then you talk about speedy trial. Let's assume you're correct.
Okay.
That we attribute the delay to conflict counsel to the state in our speedy trial analysis. And then when we get to your next point about the expert witnesses, we also attribute that to the state. If we were just simply looking at a speedy trial analysis, we look at the length of delay, then we look at other things, and we conclude your right to a speedy trial was or was not denied. But that isn't necessarily a structural error. It seems you're trying to take your speedy trial argument and make it a right to counsel argument to avoid the implications that may follow from the speedy trial analysis that wouldn't follow if we just looked at it as a structural error.
Your Honor, I would love to think I was that shrewd, but I'm really not. I think what I'm trying to do, and maybe I think I understand, Your Honor, is with both of these, I think you have to look at them as combining. I think they're dramatically intertwined here. And I think when you look at the other issue, which I think is kind of a compelling one, and just from my perspective, an interesting one, because of the relationship between the state and the court system and all that, at the second issue that we addressed is when counsel sought to retain an investigator and a psychiatrist, which I think in any capital murder case are almost de rigueur. They need them. They went to Judge Abelman. They requested it. Judge said, fine. The investigator and psychiatrist said, under the circumstances, we have a number of outstanding invoices in other cases. We're not being paid. We can no longer do it. You know, we can no longer run a tab. We need a retainer. We need to be paid. Judge Abelman, to her credit, agreed, contacted this court. This court, and I believe it was Chief Justice Steele, was in a position of having to respond, look, the legislature
hasn't provided us, and I don't want to misquote the court, hasn't provided us with sufficient funding to do that which needs to be done in this case, and really through no fault of this court's. But you now have a defendant who is faced with, do I want to prepare a trial without the requisite experts, or am I going to waive that other right? And he's being forced to choose between two constitutional rights under circumstances that have nothing to do with anything other than the fact that the state didn't fulfill its obligation to make sure his defense was funded. And this isn't someone who was asking for an exotic DNA test out of some laboratory in India. This is someone who was asking for very basic support in a capital murder case where, again, he's on trial for his life. And this court has to say, the legislature is playing games with our budget. We can't do it. And I think those two things combined, or, Your Honor, I think individually, constitute the kind of structural error that require reversal in this case. I don't want to bite into my rebuttal time if I need it. I'm assuming the court understands the rest of the issues. And again, I thank the court for permitting me to be here today.
May it please the court. For the record, Kevin M. Carroll, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state in this matter. I believe it's important to start off where Mr. Lawless left off today, and that's with the first claim he raises in the brief. And essentially what he asks this court to do is to take clearly established United States Supreme Court precedent addressing claims of structural error and stretch it to include the situation here today because he finds constitutional fault with the interplay of two errors he alleges happened at trial court. And those two errors, as the court has noted, was Mr. Page's alleged infringement of Mr. Page's right to a speedy trial, which led to state infringement on his right to effective assistance of counsel. When broken down to it,
let's assume hypothetically the state said, well, we can't provide you with counsel for 3 years. That's the hypothetical.
Yes.
Would that be a structural problem?
Well, Your Honor, it would definitely be a case other than the one we have before today.
Well, and that's why we call it hypothetical.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we also would have to analyze what implications that delay had to the defendant. If it's coming on the guise of a speedy trial violation, again, the Middlebrook and Barker v. Wingo factors would still have to lend itself to a finding of a speedy trial violation. And when we take those four factors and apply them to the facts here, it comes to one conclusion. There is no speedy trial violation. As the court has recognized, the first thing that it looks at is the length of delay. Here we have a 2-year, 6-month, 17-day delay between the time of arrest and the time that Mr. Page went to trial. There are several reasons for that, most notably defense counsel's extensive trial commitments. There was also the budgetary constraints, as well as the administrative stay put in place in the wake of Bryce v. State litigation down a couple of years ago. Now, with respect to the budgetary constraint on which Mr. Lawless places so much emphasis, the record does not lend itself to when that budgetary issue was resolved. But the motion for continuance predicated on that was filed on February 19, 2003. In March, the following month, there was an office conference in which Mr. Page's case was again scheduled for trial, beginning September 10th.
Right. Well, let's go back to my question.
Yes.
And that is, what's the state's obligation to provide counsel? We have an administrative directive in place that tries to get people to trial within a year. In this particular case, the response was, we can't do it within a year. We'll have to schedule outside a year.
Yes.
Is it your position today that the state has no obligation to provide funding for conflict counsel that would comport with the administrative directive?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, it's important to follow the administrative directive as set out in Administrative Directive 131. But by its very terms, Administrative Directive 131 establishes a flexible framework. It's a guideline establishing a 1-year period for the trial of all capital cases. And it's flexible because it needs to be. The court recognizes the budgetary issues and the obligations of counsel in this thing, in the criminal justice system, and recognizes that there will be opportunities and there will be times when trying a capital case from start to finish just simply cannot happen within 1 year. And so long as the case is tried within a reasonable time and does not run afoul of any other constitutional provision, there simply is no error. And to claim that Administrative Directive 131, as Mr. Lawless does, establishes a rigid framework for the trial of all capital cases, I think misconstrues the purpose that 131 serves, which is the orderly administration of justice. Now, these factors, the Middlebrook factors, lend itself ultimately to a determination of prejudice. And this is where Mr. Page's case falls apart. And this is why we see him trying to stretch the bounds of structural error to include this type of situation.
Well, can there ever be a structural error involving the appointment of counsel? Let's assume that the court appoints counsel who confesses on the record, I had no experience, had no ability. This guy, if I try his case, he's going to be convicted, and I'm telling you that right now. Would it be structural error to appoint that lawyer in that circumstance?
Well, I think in that case, Justice Ridgely, we come into the circumstances described by the United States Supreme Court in United States versus Chronic. And those are the circumstances that lend themselves to, you know, a finding of structural error. And chief among those is a determination of whether or not counsel in the exercise of duties is able to subject the prosecution's case to a meaningful adversarial testing. That's what happened here. There's no evidence in the record to suggest otherwise. Rather, at each turn, when defense counsel requested a continuance, it was to allow a meaningful testing of the prosecution's case. This was not a slam-dunk case in the prosecution's mind. And that's evident by the fact that, and this goes back to the second issue, Mr. Page was acquitted of the second-degree arson charge. The court can look at the sentencing order. The court can look at the docket sheet, as well as defense counsel, Mr. Lawless's brief at pages 3 and 4 during the nature and stage of proceedings. So to suggest that this was a slam dunk simply wasn't the case. Rather, defense counsel, consistent with their constitutional and ethical obligations, subjected the prosecution's case to meaningful adversarial testing. And in doing so, Mr. Page cannot credibly claim prejudice flowing from his claim of a speedy trial violation. And because there is no speedy trial violation here, there was no infringement on his right to assistance of counsel.
Does the record have anywhere in it a pro se demand for a speedy trial of any kind?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I can't say with certainty, but I certainly did not see anything in the record to reflect that. Of course, any such pro se motion made to the court would have had been rejected because Mr. Page was, in fact, represented by counsel here. But it's important to get back to the categories of structural error here, and the United States Supreme Court has been fairly straightforward. This is a limited categorical approach. And Mr. Lawless's attempts to shoehorn this into Gideon v. Wainwright and the claim of a complete denial of counsel simply is unsupportable here. The fact is, Mr. Page was represented by counsel. And Mr. Page's counsel took the necessary steps to ensure that the prosecution was held to its very high burden in this matter. Now, he may take issue with certain of defense counsel's tactics here at the trial level, but that matter is not appropriate for direct appeal, and there isn't a complete record to fully flesh it out. Accordingly, there should be no finding of structural error here, and rather, Mr. Lawless and Mr. Page must demonstrate some type of prejudice attributable to the alleged constitutional violations. Because he's unable to do so, there was no error, and there's no reason to reverse his convictions as such. With respect to the evidentiary issues raised by Mr. Page, a good starting point is probably this court's routine adherence to its decision in Calsevera. And that is, a prosecutor is not required to present the least dramatic evidence possible. I agree with Mr. Lawless. This was a brutal, heinous crime. That's the very nature of it. Photographic evidence of the scene of the arson in which Mr. Renford's body was found inside the Lexus, whether he wants to admit it or not, was probative. Mr. Page was charged with second-degree arson. Therefore, the state bore the burden of proving that Mr. Page started the fire, that he caused damage to the car, and that he acted intentionally.
How many photographs of the body were admitted at the scene of the arson?
Total, Your Honor?
Yes.
I don't know how many were total. At issue here, though, are three. And with respect to those three, it's important to note that one of those photographs, referred to as Exhibit E in the state's brief, was not objected to. There was no objection at the trial level. Accordingly, any review of the omission of that must be done under the plain error standard. And also, in the same respect, defense counsel's objection to State's Exhibit D was based on cumulative grounds, that it would have been cumulative to any autopsy photographs of Mr. Renford. Accordingly, the claim that this evidence was the omission of this evidence was an abuse of discretion because it inflamed the passion of the jury must be reviewed for plain error.
Were autopsy photographs admitted?
I believe so, yeah, Your Honor, yes. Now, in this case,
without objection.
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. Without too much debate, however, the probative value of this evidence is self-apparent. As Captain Brady of Wilmington Fire Department testified, Mr. Renford was the origin of the fire, that whomever set the victim on fire here did so by pouring gasoline on him and setting him on fire. To claim that the origin of the fire in this case was not probative of the arson charge is rather disingenuous. And a claim that this evidence somehow inflamed the jury to the point where it's reversible error belies the result here. The fact is Mr. Page was acquitted of the second-degree arson charge. The claim that the jury was inflamed as a result of this evidence, it's difficult to reconcile the two. With respect to the videotape, this was a heinous crime. This is ultimately a double homicide and an attempted murder on Mr. Renford's brother, and the crime scene was equally heinous. But consistent with Calsevera and a litany of cases following it, the prosecutor is not limited in presenting his or her evidence here. Rather, the jury must be made aware of what this crime was. And while the technology may have changed since Calsevera was originally decided, the brutality of murder, and in particular this crime, has not. This was a horrific crime. But the record clearly reflects the probative value that each piece of evidence had. With respect to the videotape, there were close-ups of the bodies to show the cause of death, to show the positioning of the victims in this case, and also to corroborate Muhammad Renford's testimony at trial. Any complaint about the presence of a pacifier in the videotape needs to be dismissed for the due to the presence of the endangering the welfare of a child charge.
Was the jury, this was a capital case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So was the jury told in advance of the trial or questioned during voir dire about their ability to view gruesome photographs?
I don't know, Your Honor, but I can tell the court that there was a standard instruction following the close of the case of the parties' summations and the presentation of evidence, that the jury was to weigh the evidence dispassionately and not to act out of sympathy, prejudice, passion, or the like. And in doing so, the result here indicates that the jury did precisely what we asked it to do as an institution. It went through the evidence dispassionately, acquitted Mr. Page of the second-degree arson charge, but convicted him of the remaining murder counts and weapons possessions. And the state asked that those convictions and the sentences be affirmed. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll conclude there.
I have just one question on the last point.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I understand the state's position. How does one square the prosecutor's ability to present the brutality of the crime through audiovisual methods and at the same time have the trial judge weigh that presentation of evidence in light of Rule 403? Is there not some point where a line has to be drawn?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that's inherent to Rule of Evidence 403.
Now, in this particular case, there was some, Mr. Lawless spent some time telling us about the commentary that went along with the videotape.
Mm-hmm.
What's your position on the extent to which there could have been relevant videotape but without commentary?
Well, Your Honor, again, that may be an issue for I understand the court's question. It's the accompanying commentary that may be the prejudicial value. Again, that's a question best left to the discretion of the trial judge here.
Well, I tend to suggest that that's probably the case, mm-hmm. but the issue here is whether the trial judge abused her discretion by allowing it in after what appears, at least arguably, a tentative finding that it's unfairly prejudicial. What's the nature of our review, understanding that the standard of review is abuse of discretion?
Well, again, it must be the court must take account for the broad discretion the trial court has here. But it's also to determine whether or not, in presenting its evidence, the prosecutor went beyond the bounds of decency here. And in reviewing the record and the case and the horrific nature of the crime, that does not, even a review under that, does not lend itself to a finding of an abuse of discretion here. The probative value of the videotape, in particular, the fact that it showed the scene here, and yes, it may have been in stark.
Yeah, I guess what I'm struggling with is I don't understand the concept, at least in as someone who's practiced law in Delaware for 37 years, that it's the role of the prosecutor to present it as graphically and as horribly as he possibly can, and the role of the defense counsel to keep out as much as he or she possibly can, and then the role of the trial judge to balance it. Strikes me that in Delaware, it's everyone's role to present only what's necessary to carry the day. And when one tries to draw the line with what the prosecutor is doing in a particular case, a murder is a murder.
Yes.
What's added to the soup by making one more horrific than another? I mean, it's a taking of a human life. Does anything get any more horrific than that in any event? And at what point does it appear that it's the evidence is being shaped or designed to do nothing more than anger the jury about a particular defendant's alleged conduct rather than illustrate for the jury why elements of a particular offense may be present in the evidence that's ultimately presented to them? That's what worries me.
Oh, I understand that, Your Honor. And certainly it is the role of every Delaware attorney to toe the line, and especially with prosecutors. We are ethically bound to pursue the interests of justice here. And obviously the interests of justice are not furthered by just introducing evidence that is graphic and heinous just for that purpose. And to suggest that that's what the prosecutor was doing in this case here, Your Honor, I think misconstrues the value that this videotape had. And certainly there will be times, as there have been in the past, where prosecutors may go too far, and that's when the court, either at the trial level or at this level, steps in to remind them of where that boundary is. But the fact is, the probative value of this videotape and these photographs in this case was significant. They bore directly on key elements of the charged offenses, and in admitting them, the trial judge acted in a reasonable manner.
Okay. Does the record reflect the state withholding photographs that otherwise existed as part of the police investigation?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I certainly have not read anything about that or seen anything consistent.
What I'm getting at is, or inquiring about, does the record reflect a selective process by the prosecutor in deciding what photographs to present?
I don't think so, Your Honor, but I certainly wouldn't want to represent that to the court. I think with the presentation of any case and the prosecution of any crime, whether it be a murder or a petty offense, I think there's always a selective process that goes into it. But I have not seen anything in the record to suggest the presence of redacted versions or the ready availability of such. And to suggest that even if they were available, that the prosecutors were somehow bound to present that in lieu of the evidence presented here, I believe unnecessarily ties the state's hands.
Well, I think the point that I take from Justice Ridgely's question is, if there were a dozen photographs, six of which were illustrative of the facts necessary to establish the case, and six were that and more in that they were graphically, explicitly gory, but unnecessarily over the top, and the prosecution selected the six that got the job done without being over the top and leaving those in a drawer back in his or her desk, then the state's case would be better than an approach that says, we want all 12. Why? Because we can get all 12.
Okay. I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would just conclude with the fact that, or reminding the court and reemphasizing the probative value that the evidence had here, and that, yes, it may have, the photographs and videotape may have displayed gruesome and horrific images, but they were directly on point, and as the trial judge determined here, the prejudicial effect did not substantially outweigh the probative value, and in doing so, did not abuse her discretion.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
With the court's permission, first of all, I want to apologize to Justice Ridgely. When you asked me about the second-degree arson charge, I missed it. Preparing for this kind of argument, sometimes your mind becomes oatmeal, and I was wrong. He was acquitted of the arson charge.
Okay. Well, my follow-up question then is, does that move the argument as to that photograph or not?
No, sir, because I think that photograph, and I think intentionally, taps into that human emotion that everyone has at one point in their life thinking about what's it like to be burned alive. It fans the flames of anger against the defendant, regardless of whether he was acquitted of the arson charge, because in the arson charge, the state had no real evidence as to who poured gasoline, who set the fire, or anything like that in the state's case in chief. So I don't think it really makes that big a difference, the fact of the acquittal.
But he wasn't he dead? Was the evidence clear that he was dead?
He was dead of a gunshot wound to the head, two gunshot wounds to the head before they set the car on fire. That was the evidence. I also wanted to state that something Chief Justice Steele said really resonated with me. 26 years ago, I wrote a book titled Prosecutorial Misconduct, and I probably take a more jaded view of prosecutors than I should because of that, but my experience has always been, unfortunately, because of the adversary system, one guy tries to do it one way, one guy tries to do it the other, and it's the judge's job to try to draw that boundary. I would like to think, and if that is the case in Delaware, I'm delighted to hear that, and I hope it is. But something the court said, which I think we have here, is you have a video of the scene, the body, and then here's blood in the hallway, and here's blood in the hallway, and here's blood in the hallway, and on with the narrative, and then the last thing you see is a close-up of a pool of blood. Again, that's the only interpretation I can come up with of that is that's an attempt to take what the judge said is unfair prejudice and use it for a specific purpose other than prove an element of the offense. And to get back to Your Honor's question regarding the conviction on arson, even before the jury's verdict, I have a question as to whether or not it would be necessary to actually show the split open portion of the body to demonstrate the origin of the incendiary nature of the fire, at least until the court makes an attempt to see if there's some other way to do it. That would really be all I would have in rebuttal. Again, I think these two instances, the 403 balancing goes way beyond where it should have.
Do you know if during voir dire the jury was asked about their ability to be fair and impartial when perhaps gruesome photographs?
Your Honor, after making the goof on the arson conviction, I wouldn't want to say yes or no. If I took a look at the record, I would be surprised. Judge Abelman tended in that trial to try to follow whatever the bench book is the court is given. I'd be surprised if that instruction wasn't given, but I don't know for sure one way or the other. Are there any other questions?
No. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.